What? What? What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Ridge.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Too Jewish is Israeli filmmaker Yonatan Ner, creator of the wonderful documentary My Hero Brother. We'll also have visits from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, our Too Jewish Mavina on Israel, Oshrat Barel, and our Shinchinim Bar El Kachar and Leah Avuno, and our maven on Jewish education, John Ben Asher. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. Over the past few weeks here on Too Jewish, we've been providing some perspective on the 50th anniversary of the Six-Day War, coming up this week with Yom Yerushalayim, Tuesday night and Wednesday, the holiday on the Jewish calendar that commemorates the unification of the Holy City of Jerusalem in 1967. 2 weeks ago, we explored the extraordinary events and miraculous military results of the Six-Day War itself in context. Talked a great deal about the capital city of Israel last week, Jerusalem, both the old and new city, East and West Jerusalem. And this week, we'll look at the other territories Israel captured or liberated during those remarkable 6 days of war exactly 50 years ago, the Sinai, the Golan Heights, and the Gaza Strip. Next week, we'll look at the many issues attending the West Bank, which all by itself could take up an entire Too Jewish radio show. First, memorably, in 1967, almost exactly 50 years ago today, Israel captured the whole Sinai Peninsula from Egypt, a victory that more than doubled the land area of the country. It was a shocking and monumental military accomplishment, and in its aftermath, Israelis enjoyed traveling the same wilderness their ancestors had wandered under Moses. They went scuba diving in Sinai. They hung out in laid-back Dahab and other oases along the Red Sea. And then, after the rude awakening of the Yom Kippur War, in an action that could have served as a model for future treaties in the region, Israel memorably exchanged the whole of the Sinai, the entirety of it, and the resorts, and especially the oil wells located there, for a peace treaty with arch-enemy Egypt. Israel's southern border has had occasional problems since the Camp David Accords concluded in the late 70s, and it might be a cold peace most of the time with Egypt, but it has been an enduring peace, and it has allowed Israel to dramatically grow, innovate, and evolve without fear of being attacked by the largest and most populous of its Arab neighbors. In the north, Israel captured the Golan Heights in the war, and for strategic reasons, it annexed them. For 20 years before 1967, Syrian snipers and artillerists shelled and shot at the kibbutzim below the heights. After the lightning conquest of the Golan and the heroic battles that retained them in 1973, very few Israelis were interested in returning the Golan Heights to Syria, even when it might have meant a peace treaty with the brutal and untrustworthy Assad regime. Although not heavily settled, the Golan Heights today are the location of excellent wineries, some farming, and many military bases that keep an eye on Syria. When I was on the Golan about 3 years ago, we could see fighting in the Syrian civil war below us in the town of Quneitra. Under Hafez al-Assad's mass-murdering son, Bashar al-Assad, what's left of the Syrian state has become an international pariah, and somehow makes ISIS look more humane than it is. As Syria continues to disintegrate, Israel's decision to hold on to the Golan and gain strategic depth and a defensible ridge of mountains looks better and better. In any case, no one is boycotting Israel in order to force her to give the Golan Heights back to Syria, and Israel certainly won't do that. In addition to East Jerusalem, the Sinai, and the Golan, another major area captured from Arab armies in 1967 was the Gaza Strip. Gaza was a hellhole then, and it's not better now. The Gaza Strip is a smallish area of land on the Mediterranean coast, 7 miles deep and perhaps 25 miles long, overpopulated, and under-resourced. In 1948, Arab residents of the former British Mandate of Palestine, not yet called Palestinians, abandoned their homes in the nascent nation of Israel and fled to Gaza, hoping to return behind the triumphant Egyptian army. When the Israelis instead defeated the Egyptians, those Arabs were stuck in Gaza, and soon the Egyptians herded them into refugee camps, rather than resettle them in their own large Arab nation. They stayed there in Gaza, overcrowded and angry on that small strip of land, until the Six-Day War of 1967, when Israel chased the Egyptian army all the way back towards Cairo. In various negotiations, including at Camp David, when they exchanged the Sinai for peace, Israel tried to give the Gaza Strip back to Egypt, but the Egyptians wanted no part of the aggrieved and seething Palestinians, whom they had treated very poorly indeed for years. And so, from 1967 until the outbreak of the First Intifada 20 years later, Gaza was a poor, overcrowded place filled with refugee camps and international aid workers, but it was also a main source of inexpensive labor for the Israeli economy, a place where Israelis shopped for furniture and vegetables and fruit. Until 1987 and the First Intifada, when all of that changed, and Gaza became a place to protect people from, rather than a place that was integrated in many ways in the Israeli economy and lifestyle. Israel's involvement in Gaza, including building some agricultural settlements and keeping an eye on things in a way consistent with the then-relaxed situation, changed dramatically from the Intifada and then again during the Oslo process, now about 20 years ago. Under Oslo, Gaza received a fair amount of autonomy under the Palestinian Authority. It was a heady time to visit. I vividly remember being in the military headquarters of the Palestinian Authority in Gaza in the mid-1990s. It was located in a building that had formerly been the Israeli police headquarters. Before that, it was the British police headquarters, and before that, the Ottoman Empire Turks police headquarters. I will never forget the astonishment on the faces of young Palestinian policemen, seeing all those Reform rabbis sitting in one room, realizing we were Jews, but not enemies. It was stunning. Well, all that optimism about Gaza came crashing down in the Second Intifada that in part led to Israel's unilateral withdrawal from Gaza in 2005, about 12 years ago, after it had occupied it for 28 years. The idea then was that after the Israeli withdrawal, Gaza would be controlled by the Palestinian Authority. If they later attacked Israel, the response could be unilateral on the IDF's part, military, greater in scope than anything the Israeli army could possibly do to an area that was under Israeli control. It sounded like a good idea at the time. But in 2007, Hamas, the religious fanatical wing of the Palestinians, won election as the leading party of Gaza. Shortly thereafter, Hamas won a brutal civil war with Fatah, the better-educated secular party for most Palestinians then. And in the decades since, Israel has fought a series of painful wars to try to keep the Hamas-led Gazan Arabs from firing rockets into Israel proper. Gaza has been partly destroyed in each of these wars, but under Hamas, efforts are always redoubled after being defeated by the IDF. They find new and creative ways to try to attack Israel. A huge network of terrorist invasion tunnels were built by the Hamas-led Palestinians. Israel finds them and destroys them, and then they rebuild them to again try to attack Israeli citizens. There is an uneasy quiet now with Gaza, occasional missile, but it seems likely there will almost inevitably be another war sometime, and the IDF will pound Gaza again. It's not pretty. In effect, in the territories we've discussed today, the Sinai, the Golan, and the Gaza Strip, Israel has tried three very different approaches to the challenges of occupying the lands of another people and religion. With the Sinai, Israel used its assets, land and oil in particular, to trade for peace with Egypt. With the Golan, Israel simply kept a lightly settled area of great military value, annexed it, made it its own. With Gaza, Israel tried semi-benign neglect at first, followed 20 years later by armed occupation and suppression, and then, eventually, withdrawal. And with Jerusalem, last week's featured location, Israel annexed the city, Israel's eternal capital, outright. None of these approaches necessarily worked better than any others might have. In the absence of comprehensive peace treaties with the Palestinians, it's difficult to know what might have worked better, or even what might work better in the future. We do know one thing, though. In the 50 years since the Six-Day War, Israel has changed dramatically, amazingly, while the areas that were occupied have changed much less, and not nearly as well, with the exception, on both counts, of Jerusalem. And Israel has flourished much more because of what has happened within its original territory than because of what the conquests of 1967 brought. Next week, we'll tackle the thorniest of current problems, the West Bank. But today, to play us in this morning of the week commemorating the 50th anniversary of the Six-Day War, here's Israeli singer Gad Elbaz singing of Jerusalem, his song Yerushalayim, based on the psalm, "If I forget thee, may my right hand lose its cunning, if I don't put Jerusalem above my chiefest joy." That was Gad Elbaz, his setting of the psalm Yerushalayim, Jerusalem. Our guest this morning, Yonatan Ner, is a documentary filmmaker of talent and delight. His new movie is about Israelis taking the obligatory long trip after their IDF military service and the Down syndrome siblings that go along. It's called My Hero Brother, and it's wonderful. Meet filmmaker Yonatan Ner. Find out how he made this project work when we return in a moment here on Too Jewish.
Hi, Doris. How are you?
Well, Carol, to be honest, now that I'm a little older, I can't get out as much as I'd like. I miss seeing people.
Why don't you come over to my place for lunch on us? The food's delicious. So many choices. And I have a special table with my friends every day. They'd love to have you join us.
Is there much to do there?
There are lots of activities every day. Mondays is Mahjong. Tuesdays, I do yoga. Wednesdays, we go shopping or to the museum or a restaurant. Thursdays, my exercise class. There are book groups, speakers, Shabbos services, concerts, a game room. I'm busier than ever.
Where do you live?
I'm at Handmaker. And the people are great. Please come over for lunch. You'll love it. It's even kosher. Just call me at 322-7035.
Handmaker Jewish Services for the Aging offers the full spectrum of quality senior living and post-hospital rehabilitative care. Call 322-7035. Handmaker for life. 322-7035.
We are delighted to welcome the Two Jewish. Our guest this morning is Yonatan Ner, the filmmaker of an extremely interesting Israeli film called My Hero Brother. Good morning and welcome to Two Jewish.
Hello, how are you doing?
Doing well. Tell us what motivated you to start on this project.
Well, I think in all my career as a storyteller or as a filmmaker, I'm always looking for stories with hope, stories that, you know, usually happening outside in the outdoors. I love the outdoors. I love traveling. And at some point in 2013, I received a phone call from a friend who told me about this group of young people with Down syndrome were planning to go on a trip in the Himalayas together with their siblings. And I said, you know, I'm in. It was so, I knew that it will bring out so many interesting stories and emotions. So I wanted to be a part of it.
The story itself is very compelling. The notion of, you know, who's the hero is really interesting because it's not kind of what we think. Can you explain a little bit about the title?
Yeah, I mean, you know, when this whole project started way before I was involved in it, it started with a guy named Enosh Kassel, who has a brother that has Down syndrome. And Enosh, like many other Israelis, went traveling right after the military service.
It's like a law. You finish the IDF, you've done 3 years of military service, and you go to Thailand or South America or India. It's a very common Israeli experience, of course.
Very common. And his experience was very good, just like me. I had an amazing experience right after the army, traveling the world. And then he said to himself, you know, I have a brother named Hanan. He has Down syndrome, and he will never have the chance to travel like me without me. And the only chance for him to have this kind of experience would be if I would take him with me on a similar trip. And that's exactly what he did. So Enosh and Hanan went on this private trip, one-on-one, in 2012. And when they came back, Enosh had a little camera with him, a video camera, and he recorded the whole experience. And he brought it to the Israeli news, and they made a report about it. And it was a very popular report. And a day later, he started to receive many phone calls from similar people to him, people that also has a brother or a sister with Down syndrome. And they basically told him, you know, we want to do the same thing. We wish we had the guts that you have. We don't know how to do it. And then he decided, together with his friend Itamar Peleg, was like an owner of a travel company, to create this group, and he called this group My Hero Brother. And then they started to meet each other in Israel and to travel in Israel for more than a year, and only after this year they raised the funds in order to go to India. So the name of the group was already there when I started to follow them with my crew, with my cameras. And I asked myself, what should be the name of the film? And I thought, you know, it's a great name, and it raises the question, who is the hero? And for me, when I started to make this film, I thought that the heroes are the brothers that doesn't have Down syndrome. But I think if you watch the film, you see how the perspective is changing, and at some point, the cameras is more attracted to the people with the Down syndrome, because they have so many things to teach us, and we can learn so much from them. I'm not sure who's their hero.
I know. Yeah. It's a remarkable experience. We'll talk much more about what we can learn from these Down syndrome individuals and the film My Hero Brother. We'll return in a few moments here on Too Jewish.
Is your aging loved one unhappy and having a hard time adjusting to life around them? The TMC Geropsychiatric Center at Handmaker may be able to help. TMC Geropsych specializes in providing short-term inpatient services for older adults experiencing behavioral health issues. Did you know that most people with depression get better when they seek help? With the right treatment, those with anxiety can overcome and learn to cope with their fears, and individuals with dementia can continue leading quality lives. Our team, led by a geriatric psychiatrist, brings expertise from disciplines across a variety of specialties to ensure your loved one receives the right diagnosis and treatment. For more information about our services, please call 324-4600. The TMC Geropsychiatric Center at Handmaker. Call 324-4600. Let's talk about how we can help.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit our website at twojewishradio.com, TOOJewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website. Streaming us from there or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store is very popular Jewish podcasts. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
So the French election's over, and the new leader of France is not Marine Le Pen, but Macron, a guy that we don't know much about in the United States. It's different, a vote for Marine Le Pen than a vote for Brexit, than a vote for Donald Trump. Maybe we can take kind of a little global look at all of this.
Yeah, I think there's a pretty popular idea cultivated by the media, in this country at least, that the same forces that brought Donald Trump to the White House caused the Brits to vote to leave the European Union and caused a surprisingly large vote for a far-right candidate in France. Let me just note for the record that the French, whom we often like to tease and pummel and say bad things about, voted against her by a margin of 2-1. It was basically 66-33. And that shows pretty good sense in terms of what they consider France to be and what they consider French values to be. Marine is definitely less racist, anti-Semitic, Holocaust-denying, et cetera, than her father was. But it may just be that she is more politically savvy and keeps a tighter lid on those things. One doesn't really know. I mean, nobody knows the real Marine Le Pen, whatever that might be. But she was clearly more palatable than her father was roughly 30 years ago when he ran and did surprisingly well in the first round, got like 16%. She did better than that in the first round this time in France, but ultimately was handed a stunning defeat. So the reason I think that all these phenomena are different and not different facets of the same gem is that the French feel that their country is under attack in a different way from the way in which either Americans or Brits feel that. The French have brushed off many serious incidents of terrorism since the 70s, and they don't consider that an attack against France. What they consider an attack against France is the existence of McDonald's in every big city in France, or the existence of Starbucks.
That might be an attack on France, actually.
The slow but gradual disappearance of the traditional bistro and the traditional cafe and basically the French way of life, which, when all is said and done, however you feel about France and the French, the French way of life was pretty nice. They had long paid vacations every year. They spent a lot of time savoring good coffee, good wine, watching people walk by in good clothes. The quality of life in France is definitely worth trying to preserve. And I think the difference between these two candidates was not so much right-left or even pro-immigrant, anti-immigrant. The difference is, what does it mean to preserve French identity, French culture, and French values? And people showed what they think it means by voting overwhelmingly for Macron.
You know, and of course, that always raises the central question, but is it good for the Jews? And we can talk about that another time. Thanks so much, Tom.
I look forward to the next session.
We welcome our Mivina in Israel, Oshrat Barel, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Oshrat.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
You know, there's a custom in Israel after the army where kids, they're kids to me, but they're just out of the army, having lived in the small country of Israel their whole life, and they go off, either it's to South America to go hike all over South America, and there's a sort of Israeli backpacker tour there, or India, or up to the Himalayas. And it's a very important part of the function of Israeli society. There's a film about a very interesting aspect of that. I think you're showing it here tonight.
Tonight, yes. The name of the movie is My Hero Brother. And it's exactly about this, you know, how you shape Israeli identity. And part of, you know, Israeli identity, you go to high school, you go to army, and then you go to the trip after the army.
Right.
And then you go to the university, hopefully get married.
Have children, and so on.
Yeah, but this is really like component that rarely you skip. So the idea, the movie was made about one family that decided, the two brothers of Enosh decided to take his brother and to give him this experience of, you know, Himalaya trek. So I guess in the same family, they will have the same language, same experience, that they can talk about it, because specific Enosh, his brother is less function than the other people on the trip that people will come and see tonight in the movie. Anyway, so
it's about impairment, and I think there's kids with various different kinds of impairments.
Yes. So the movie is like following the kids from the families, actually, from the very beginning through the trip itself, all the difficult, really difficult moments, and then the victory of seeing all this group on, you know, the top of the mountain, like, what was beautiful that it calls My Hero Brother, and you can you will think that it was about the syndrome, Down syndrome kid that is my hero, but it was one of the Down syndrome kid that called his brother My Hero Brother. So it's
because he helped him have this fantastic experience.
Yes, and we will have what will be unique is that we will have the filmmaker. So we will have reception with the filmmaker before the screening, and then a Q&A after the screening. Another uniqueness is that we are hosting this event together with an organization called SANDS, Southern Arizona Network for Down Syndrome, here in Tucson. And I expect a very moving evening tonight.
Yeah, it should be really powerful, and I've heard it's a great film. Tell me what time it is and where it's going to be.
6 p.m. at the JCC.
Really should be extraordinary. And I have to say, you know, I've been with some of these Israeli backpackers. I had Seder with about, I don't know, 1,000 of them in Cuzco, Peru a couple of years ago. It's a very standard kind of experience, but obviously one that can also be elevated, not only physically, but spiritually.
Nachon.
Thanks, Ashrat.
Toda rabbi.
We welcome our maven on Jewish education, John Ben Asher, head of the Tucson Hebrew Academy. Boker Tov, John.
Boker Tov, good morning.
Good morning. I don't know how many graduations you've been to this year, but oh my goodness. You know, they used to all be called graduations.
Yeah.
We have our preschool graduation, our early childhood education center. They graduate into kindergarten,
right.
Grade school, middle school, high school, of course, college, graduate school, I don't know, rabbinic ordination. You can keep going. What are we trying to teach by all of these milestones?
Sure. Well, you know, there's an interesting distinction that we're careful about these days to kind of say graduation is sort of what you do at the end of high school. Right. And now the language is promotion or matriculation. But whatever you want to call it, it's important to celebrate these markers, these mileposts.
I don't think I went to a graduation ceremony till my son graduated, but there were a whole lot of promotion ceremonies.
Yeah. You know, and different people have different opinions about this kind of thing. There are some that believe that there's a little bit too much of, you know, recognitions and rewards. But I personally think that it's important to celebrate. And, you know, it's good to give strokes and to help kids as they're growing up feeling good about who they are. Certainly, we want them to be challenged and not just, you know, given kudos without earning them. But the whole point is to say, you have reached a significant place in your life. You've shown up, you've done the work required, you've participated, you've been part of something important. And now, you know, pat on the back, good for you. You made it here. Let's take a moment and savor it, much like we savor when we complete one of the books of the Torah, Chazak, Chazak, V'nil Chazek, and we celebrate with something sweet. We kind of honor and recognize that, you know, you've done a nice job and there's more ahead, but right now let's take this moment and celebrate.
You know, when I was growing up, I thought that college was something you just went to after high school. I didn't even know you had to like apply. Everybody in my family was just expected automatically to go.
That's very fortunate.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting because my mom's parents didn't go to college, you know, but it had been institutionalized by the next generation.
Right.
When we do these promotions, or we call them commencements, you know, you've only just begun. We're trying to teach that education is lifelong, and by celebrating the milestones, we're trying to not end them, but push the kids along.
I think that's a great point, because education is important. And as we're growing up, we want to be reinforcing that. And so it does provide that opportunity for closure, but also for opening up the next chapter. And it's classic for these events to have a speaker who kind of exemplifies what you can be as you continue to go through life and have aspirations and, you know, try to achieve and do something with yourself. So it's not uncommon to have an alumnus speaker or a leader come, you know, at the colleges and universities. They have some of the cream of the crop come and do their commencement speeches. It's got to be very inspiring.
I think it's a great point. And, you know, boy, Torah means education. Nothing could exemplify this better. Mm. Thanks, John. We'll talk next week.
Have a great week.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear the old Jewish joke of the week.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie New, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Jacob is nearly 100 years old and he's dying. He says to his wife, "Darling, it's time. Please call for a priest." His wife says, "But Jacob, we're Jewish." And Jacob says, "What? I should bother the rabbi at this hour of the night?" If only it were still like that. That was the old Jewish joke of the week. Special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week we read the portion Bamidbar, first in the book of Numbers, which is given its name by the census that occupies a good part of the beginning of our Torah portion. Superficially, it's just a listing of names and numbers, and not a very interesting text for study or certainly inspiration. But it also teaches us a primary lesson. Every human being counts in God's eyes, and should similarly count in our eyes as well. There's an unusual phrase in the beginning of the portion. The survey is to be taken of the entire nation, bimispar shemot, by the numbering of names. In other words, even though by definition a census is an accounting, a totaling of sums, each individual must be accounted for not by number, but name. Each person has a unique identity, a human face. Each is an image of God. The notion that every human being counts is part of our tradition in many ways. From the requirement that we have 10 Jewish adults for a minyan to the requirement that we must view every other person as a Tzelem Elohim, an image of God no different from ourselves in holiness. The Talmud tells us that one who saves a single life is accorded the merit of having saved the whole world. Each of us is counted because we all count. Paradoxically, even counting itself can be transformed into an affirmation of that sanctity. In this period between Pesach and Shavuot, we count each day of the Omer as a kind of special preparation, remembering the connection between freedom and covenant. We count every day so that we can make every day count. And when we do the tabulation that lets us know that we have the 10 required for a minyan, the minimum required for prayer, traditionally we don't count by numbers, since that would devalue every human being into a mere digit. Instead, we find a verse from the Bible that has 10 exact words. Work our way through it until we have completed the passage, thus making every member of that accounting part of a holy sentence. In a world of numbers, it's comforting to realize that we are each much more than the sum of our parts. No matter how we seek to quantify and digitize our world, each one of us, especially you, matters to God. And that is worth recounting again and again. When we return on to Jewish, our guest, Israeli filmmaker Yonatan Ner, will explain just who a real hero is. Find out when we come back in a moment on To Jewish.
My name is John Ben Asher, and I'm the head of school at the Tucson Hebrew Academy. Tucson Hebrew Academy is a pluralistic kindergarten through eighth grade Jewish day school. We foster educational excellence through an interdisciplinary, integrated general studies and Judaic curriculum. We teach our students to apply Jewish values and learning to everyday life, enabling them to make their community and the world a better place. Our engaging, talented faculty ensure a rigorous, interactive, supportive learning environment. From the early years through comprehensive high school prep, children thrive in THA's uniquely enriching educational community and culture. Our 41-year tradition of excellence continues to produce highly skilled, critical, and creative thinking students with a strong moral compass and deep understanding of Jewish identity, traditions, and values, well prepared for the challenges to come. Tucson Hebrew Academy, thaaz.org, 529-3888.
We continue with our Two Jewish Update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Israel was the source of the classified intelligence that U.S. President Donald Trump disclosed to Russian officials last week, according to many reports released just days before Trump's first visit to Israel. Two U.S. officials, one current and one former, said Trump shared the intelligence supplied by Israel in the fight against Islamic State with Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov and Russian Ambassador Sergei Kislyak during an Oval Office meeting last week, which Trump barred the American press from attending. While Israeli officials have not confirmed they were the source of intelligence, Israel's ambassador to the U.S., Ron Dermer, said Israel has full confidence in our intelligence-sharing relationship with the United States and looks forward to deepening that relationship in the years ahead under President Trump. There were also news reports that hinted the Middle Eastern country that was the source of the intelligence Trump shared with the Russians might be Jordan, but most authorities believe that the intelligence he shared so recklessly came from Israel. There are several that indicate that an Israeli intelligence agent planted deep within the Islamic State has now had his life endangered by the U.S. president's carelessness. And President Trump visits Israel starting tomorrow, his first trip to the Jewish state as chief executive. We will see how he is received and perceived, especially since he now seems to be backing away from moving the U.S. Embassy from Tel Aviv to the actual capital of Israel, Jerusalem. In non-Trump news about Israel, Israeli Housing Minister Yoav Gallant last week condemned the genocide taking place in Syria, adding it's time to eliminate President Bashar al-Assad following U.S. accusations that the regime is using a crematorium to hide atrocities being committed outside Damascus. The reality in which people are executed in Syria, being hit deliberately by chemical weapons, their bodies being burned, something we haven't seen in 70 years. We are crossing a red line. It's time to eliminate Assad literally. Gallant, a former major general in the IDF, head of the Southern Command and a member of the National Security Council of Israel, said at the Second International Ground Warfare and Logistics Conference at Latrun, outside of Jerusalem. Earlier, Gallant charged that the rule of the Assad regime is the worst since the Nazis, led by Adolf Hitler in Germany during World War II. What's happening in Syria is defined as genocide under all classifications, Gallant said. The Kulanu party leader added that Israel wants to see Assad and his Alawite regime fall from power and be replaced by a moderate Sunni ruler. We can only hope. In Europe, the chief rabbi of Brussels urged a senior EU official to intervene to prevent Belgium's largest region from banning ritual slaughter of animals. Rabbi Albert Guigui made the plea publicly in the presence of Frans Timmermans, the first vice president of the European Commission, during a rabbinical conference in Hoofddorp, about 15 miles south of Amsterdam, where Timmermans spoke as guest of honor before 250 members of the Conference of European Rabbis. Guigui referenced a vote last week by a committee of the Parliament of the Walloon region, one of Belgium's three, that would make it illegal to kill animals in the meat industry without stunning them first, which is not acceptable under Kashrut rules. We ask you as our friend and ally to join this fight, a fight for religious freedom, Guigui told Timmermans during the 60th anniversary convention of the Conference of European Rabbis. Jewish and Muslim ritual slaughter of animals require animals be conscious when their necks are cut. The Jewish variant, shchita, may only be performed by highly qualified professionals known as shochtim, or shechets, if you wish, and according to strict regulation. The Muslim slaughter of animals is more liberal and may be performed by anyone for the production of halal meat, but it must be done correctly. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews Round the World. We welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning. He's filmmaker Yonatan Ner, who created the film My Hero Brother, a remarkable story about, well, I think it captures both something uniquely Israeli and something uniquely human, both, and the relationship between siblings and who have completed their army service and who are taking their Down syndrome siblings with them. What do you think the most important lessons are that you learned in making this film about those with Down syndrome?
Well, I think that when you spend time with them, you start to realize that they have amazing qualities that I think we could all, you know, take something from them. For example, they have this amazing ability to show love, to express emotions in general. They also have this ability to be in the moment, so they can be very angry or sad at some point, and 5 minutes later, they will be really, really happy, and, you know, and with us, or at least with me, I have everything goes through the process of the brain. You know, if I feel something, I will get it through the process of my brain and through my filters and through my past experiences and fears from what would happen if I will do that or that, and I'm thinking so much. With them, it seems like they react you know, directly from the heart. And it's just opening your heart when you're spending time with them. It's really like addictive, you know. In the beginning, when I met them for the first time, you know, they stood in line almost and hugged me one after the other. And it's, you know, in the beginning I was a bit embarrassed. You know, I don't know these people, and they come and they hug me, and they don't hug for a second. They can hug you for half a minute. And then you start to think to yourself, you know, we should behave a bit more like that. You know, when we meet somebody and we feel good about him and we, you know, we want to give him a hug, it's okay. And the amount of times that they say, I love you in this film, I mean, it would be, if I would do it with so-called, you know, with people who doesn't have Down syndrome, people will tell me that it's like... it's too sweet, you know. It's like
it's like Manischewitz.
With them, it's so, yeah, and with them, it's so normal, you know. He feels like he wants to say "I love you," and give a kiss to his brother, and then kiss the Indian porter that carries the bag with us. He will do that, and I think this is something really beautiful.
So part of the story of the film, without giving it away, is ascending a peak, climbing a peak. Can you talk about that experience?
The idea of the organizers was to hike to a peak of a mountain. It's a mountain that is around Nanda Devi, which is a very, very, very high mountain, very, very sacred for the Hindus. But we, of course, didn't climb the Nanda Devi, but we climbed a small mountain that you can see a beautiful view of other mountains, and it was quite high. It was 3,500 meters, I think around 11,000 feet. No, even more than that. You'll have to check it out. I'm using the metric system.
Yeah, that's okay.
And I think, you know, the idea was to get them to this mountain and to get this experience of walking in the Himalayas for a few days, spending the nights in tents, being in nature, surrounded by nature. And it was beautiful to see because, you know, they were walking brother and sister together in the middle of the Himalayas. The group started this hike or this trek all together, but of course with the time they spread on a few miles sometimes. And they just had this time spend with their brother or sister for a long time. The trek itself was 5 days, but then, you know, just to get there took us 2 or 3 days, and to go back took us another 2 or 3 days, and then we did some other things in Rishikesh, in other places in India, so they will get more from the Indian experience. So the total was 2 weeks, but the hike was 5 or 6 days. And they wanted to get to this top of the mountain, and it was difficult because people with Down syndrome, they tend to have altitude sickness in lower
elevations. Yeah, lower elevations, right.
Elevations. So we had a doctor, of course, with us. And, I mean, if you watch the film at some point, I'm not going to tell you the whole story, but at some point or a few points, we really thought that, you know, we're turning back and we can't do it. I think for me, in the beginning, I really wanted to reach this peak. But as we were walking, I realized that the film is not about, it's not a physical journey. It's an emotional journey. It's a spiritual journey, and it's a journey into the heart. It's a journey into the relationship between them, a little bit go back with the memories to what does it mean to grow up next to a Down syndrome, next to a brother with Down syndrome or a sister with Down syndrome. So it's mostly about, I think, the relationship between them.
You know, it's the journey, not the arrival, right? It's a platitude. It's a cliche. But you really begin to see in this film, it's that whole process that's so beautiful. You have made other films which also have a heart. I think of your film Dolphin Tale, or Dolphin Boy, rather. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, Dolphin Boy was my first film. I've done it in 2011. Together with my friend, my co-director Danny Menken, and the co-producer Judith Menasson Ramon, and Dolphin Boy was, you know, big success. It was sold to Disney Pictures that wanted to remake it into a fiction film, and it was shown in more than 20 different countries worldwide, won many awards. And Dolphin Boy was about a young Arab Israeli teenager who was beaten cruelly and bullied basically in his school, and he stopped speaking with people. He could not talk anymore as a result of this trauma, and his father, which is an amazing character, takes him to be rehabilitation process with dolphins in the dolphin reef in Eilat,
right, in the Red Sea. Yeah.
And I was working there as a cameraman. Before I was making films, I was a nature photographer and underwater photographer and cinematographer. So I was working them right when they came, and it was right after the second Lebanon War. And in the second Lebanon War, I was injured. I was in the, you know, in the military service, in the reserve forces, and I was injured. So coming back from the war, working with these dolphins really helped my rehabilitation process. So I knew that I want to make a story, to tell the story of the connection between men and dolphins and how this connection can help people in troubles. And right a few weeks later, this teenager, together with his father, came to the dolphin reef. So I knew instantly that this will be my way to tell my own story through his story. So that was one film. I made another film called Cutting the Pain, which was also a big success in Israel. And now My Hero Brother is doing really great. I mean, we've been screening it over 250 times in Israel and almost 100 times in the United States in festivals and other venues. It won a few awards, including the Audience Award and the Best Documentary Award in the Santa Barbara International Film Festival. So I'm really happy that, you know, it's such a story that comes from Israel and doesn't deal with politics, doesn't deal with this kind of things, but just, you know, deal with human beings that are trying to do something good with their lives. And I'm very happy that this, you know, this kind of films also inspire people and, you know, and open their hearts and, you know, hopefully help them in their own journeys.
It's a wonderful film. It's going to be here in Tucson, as will Yonatan there, May 21st at 7 o'clock at the JCC. I want to thank you for a great visit here on Too Jewish. Where can people go to find out more about you and more about your work?
Well, first of all, you know, we can become friends on Facebook. My name is Yonatan Meir, and I also have a company named Hate Youth Productions, together with my partner Danny Menkin, who's living in Los Angeles. So we're basically an LA Israeli-based production company. And we're making films all the time. I'm just, you know, I'm having a new film coming out in 2 days in the Doc Aviv Festival in Tel Aviv, which is a very prestigious film festival here in Israel. So that's going to be a new film that's coming out really soon.
And what's it called?
It is called The Essential Link, The Story of Wilfred Israel. Wilfred Israel was one of the greatest saviors of Jews during the Holocaust period, a man who was a key figure in the initiation and organization of the Kinder Transport operation, a man whom Albert Einstein was described as the noblest man he had ever met, a man who was a figure in Goodbye to Berlin by Christopher Isherwood, which became Cabaret. A man who died on the same airplane together with Leslie Howard, who acted in Gone with the Wind. A person who was involved in the saving of thousands, or even some historians say tens of thousands of Jews from Germany during the 30s. And yet, almost nobody heard his name. And my film is about this man and about the reasons for his disappearance from history. And it will surely... you know, make a nice tour in the States, probably later this year as well.
Don't forget to come see his film, My Hero Brother, May 21st at 7 o'clock, and you can see him on Skype as well, modern technology at work. Thank you so much, Yonatan.
Thank you very much, Rabbi.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday. Our guest on Too Jewish will be Pamela Schuler, remarkable Jewish inclusion advocate and stand-up comedian. Her story is truly unique and very special. And of course, listen to all of our podcasts on iTunes or at our TooJewishRadio.com website. Our playout this morning comes from the Israeli film Fill the Void, another version of Im Eshkachech Yerushalayim, If I Forget Thee, Jerusalem, for Yom Yerushalayim, coming this week, Tuesday night and Wednesday. It's a setting of the psalm by Yitzchak Azulai. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
Im Eshkachech Yerushalayim, Tishkach Yemini. Im Eshkachech Yerushalayim.
rak l'shoyni l'chiki im lo yezgereichi im lo yare es Yerushalayim ala voish simechosi im lo yezgereichi im lo yare es Yerushalayim
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.